Tonight, we are going to finish up on socialism as a subject. And I notice we're sort of thinning out a little bit. I can't imagine it's the spring weather. I don't want to think it's lack of interest in the subject, but you never know. Sometimes people say, well, I don't really need to know that. But then other times there are things that just interfere with Wednesday night. I know that's possible. So I guess I don't want to bore you with our stuff. Our lesson today is hopefully not boring. Kind of the last lesson, like I say, on socialism, and it's like when you do a movie, I guess you get all these scraps of paper or ideas laying around. You finally say, now this is the last week we have to use this stuff, so let's put it together in some kind of lesson. So that's what we have today. There are parts I would like to go in more depth, but we will forego that and deal with somewhat a summarizing of what we've learned and dig a little further into things we haven't learned and repeat stuff. Again, if you get like to thinking, well, I've heard that before, that's probably good because at least you remember you heard it before. And if you hear it three or four times, this stuff is not easy to remember how it works. And I'm so committed to finish this partly because I want to know about it, the next seven lessons. Next seven lessons are going to be on the biblical aspect of economics. We've been looking at the alternative view that man has come up with, one of their eternal alternative views, which is quite dominant in the world, socialism. So we'll use it always because what we've done now is a background for it, and we'll always use what the Bible says and be able to bounce off of that and be able to show how wrong it has been and why it has been such a disaster. So I put up dialectic materialism because it's kind of a fancy sounding word and name and no one really understands it. And frankly, I've worked hard at understanding it. I think I've got my mind on it a little bit because I've tried so hard to find out what dialectic means. Dia means two. Lectic, I just can't figure out what it means. So we'll talk about that a little bit because it is the basis for socialism, at least the communism variety of it that flourished in the Eastern European nation of Russia. All right, to get our minds into the right track again, we've explained why the world is the way it is. I use this all the time now that I have developed this sort of expression with people that I talk with. We have explained the world the way it is in five events, remember? We've also noted that the world is not a safe place. I don't know what else you want to say then. It's that. I've used the word safe place. In other words, there's dangers, there's disappointments, there's all kinds of bad things happen. There are some good things that happen as well, but we would have to be very careful to live in this place because it is not a safe place. My sister-in-law just fell and broke her hip. I guess it's not a safe place. The one that lost her husband. It's not a safe place. And you've got a son, there you go, in a serious accident in Kansas City. This is not a safe place. So harmful things are going to happen. And we have, besides creation, we have the four judgment events. Some are traceable to human choices. Some are due to general and personal consequences, be subjects of the fall. The worldwide flood example, the division of language are examples of that. And we also know that each of us are unique individuals born in various circumstances with various abilities, with duties and responsibilities. Therefore, equality of station, production, outcome, longevity, and so forth are impossible. In fact, I think biblically undesirable. So number one and two elements are undeniable realities. Now the third is, I hope what you remember, after you remember the first two points, but what happens when you try to mitigate the judgments of God? Number three, an attempt to change one and two will wreak havoc on the God-established system, even though it is an established system of judgment. And we just say, well, that is just the way it is. When you tell our kids, when they complain about how things are, it is just the way it is. But some will not accept this. They work to reverse these the effects of the judgments. And that's been our study in the socialism section. Now, the damage done in any attempt to reverse the judgments makes human existence worse than the judgment itself. You might want to think about that. I might be wrong about that. But I think that is the end result of this. So we live in a damaged world, judged by God, and guess what? It gets further damaged by the humans that live on it. So, okay, trying to mitigate these judgmental events in our life makes life worse than it was before. It renders accelerated poverty, disease, misery, death, and could add many more things there. No matter how well-intentioned, any attempt to nullify the curses of the judgment will be. It will be disaster for all. Now, the politicians around the world may promise relief from the judgment, but they are incapable of delivering any help. Actually, they pile on the misery. So our lesson this year investigates one of the human economic systems to mitigate the curses of God's judgment. Wouldn't that be just like man trying to undo what God has said? I'm going to judge you. And the man says, no, you're not. God said, I'm going to judge you. He says, no, you're not. Man says, I'm going to bring heaven on earth, whether you like it or not, God. Of course, generally they'll agree to believe in God, but you know that's how the argument would go if it was to be had. Our study is focused on the scheme of socialism, where the group, not the individual, is responsible for his condition. He believes with blind religious zeal that the group can solve the quagmire of human misery. Of course, the group always has to have a leader. By the way, it has to have a leader, footnoted. What causes human misery? Well, they say the ownership of private property does. Eliminate private property and the benefits of that one act will cascade down to eliminate all misery. Well, some things cannot be changed. The judgment of God is one such thing. As human beings, we are tempted to try anything to relieve suffering. We all try. We all take aspirin when we have a headache. We put a bandage on our cuts. We sleep when we're tired. But remember the Tsarina and her hemophiliac son? She even went to what appeared to be a demonic for help. The results were catastrophic for her family. All were executed, and the Russian government was destroyed. The Romanov dynasty government ended after 304 years. After another 50 years or so, 76 or thereabout, percentage of the population of the earth was in the grips of the diabolical communists. Who would have thought that by trying to avoid suffering, which she was, 100 million people would die, plus the untold misery of those that didn't die, a million more. Too simple? Well, you look at the history, maybe, but do not minimize the implications of even a small mistake. When God cursed the earth at and after the fall, it should be expected then that the world would become a dangerous and indiscriminately cruel place. After all, that's what judgments are for. Of course, we as Christians do not despair at this reality, but find it, this reality, a way of explaining what can or cannot be changed. In any case, it does not change the Genesis mandate to fill and multiply and subdue. It just makes it harder. And we might say even impossible to complete, I think, before the kingdom. In other words, before the restoration, we have passages that talk about the restoration and the new heavens and the new earth. So Christians live in peace under these four judgments. We sit here as testimony to that, knowing that each is authored by God, that his judgments act as waypoints to the restoration of all things. Also, Christians know that suffering is not normal, nor is it natural, and it will be removed in the restoration. Christians can endure anything with that hope, Titus 2:13. Think of the peaceful martyrdom many have endured over the ages. However, the natural man has no such hope. He only has a dreadful fear of judgment in the life to come. As a proverbial ostrich who is willingly blind, man attempts to ignore the final judgment and spends his life theorizing plans to eliminate the suffering in this world. Political figures, motivated by altruism or not, sometimes we don't know, put forth the ultimate solutions. In our case, Marx and Lenin et al. Have offered the cause of misery, unequal wealth. However, the presumed antidote is actually a poison. The latter condition being much worse than having done nothing. Remember, to Tsarina, who had this hemophiliac son, would have been better off, I don't want to say letting him die, but not going to the extent of trying to treat him. Sometimes it's better to do nothing. Remember earlier I said their curse is worse than God's curse? Maybe that's a play on words, but I think you've got to think about that a little bit. The two factors in play. This will develop in our next half of our studies, the last seven lessons. While the world is under judgment, there is still a God-given order of economics. God intends humanity to function under judgment, not to give up and die and go away. Function under judgment and make progress in fulfilling the Genesis mandate, not sitting on the hill with white sheets waiting for all of it to end. Another factor, the task of improving on God's economic plan is impossible. Whatever plan God has for us to function in judgment, there cannot be a better plan. So two illustrations, Coumadin and driving your car, very common things. If you know what Coumadin is, you don't have anybody on it, it gets a blood thinner. My dad was on it, probably died because, not of it, but because of the disease he had or whatever the condition. I don't like to call it a disease, a condition. Coumadin is used as a blood thinner before humans could benefit from it. Many rats died. Beasts might say not enough. But with enough testing, the drug is useful and reasonably safe for human blood thinning, removing blood clots and polycythemia, which is what my dad had. On the surface, this is simple, but the reality is quite complex. How many rats died? How many humans maybe died or were inconvenienced or damaged by testing? We don't know that. And then you look at all the warnings on any drug. You know, sometimes they, you know, heard these on ads on TV, they go on and on and on and on and on. And then you see the ads in like a magazine, they got two pages of small print ads that warn you about taking this drug. But they smile at you when they do it. And they're good looking people that tell you you should take their drug. So you can add to your list of health things that can go wrong. It is easy to have so many meds that a true diagnosis becomes impossible. You know people like that. Maybe you've been through that routine. This is an example of complexity. It is impossible to manage except on a very, very marginal basis. I'm always amazed at what the doctors can do. Are you not? But I'm also amazed what they cannot do. Driving a car on dry pavement, even at interstate speeds, is relatively safe for most of us. However, add the simple element of a glaze of ice and driving becomes so complicated that wisdom says, leave your car parked. On a slick road, you are subject to your own mistakes, driving too fast, oversteering in a skid, braking into a skid, plus all the other fools on the road who are doing the same thing, and their mistakes putting you in danger even if you drive with prudence. So driving is very complicated with the addition of adding one surprise element, ice. But what about the mechanical failures, the distractions, the blackouts, and goes on and on. What all could happen? And we have reduced fatalities on the roadways a lot, but we've spent a lot of money doing it, haven't we? And they're still getting killed on the roadway. Well, lulled into complacency, because the world functions so well, and it does because God holds it together, Colossians 1:17, we get the idea that It's simple to manage. Any caveman can do it. In fact, somebody said to me one time, you know how you never noticed when you wash your car, it always runs a lot smoother? That's true. You might try that sometime. You wash your car, and you get in it, and it drives quieter. Everything just... That's kind of how things are when we think we've changed things. Now, so add a dose of human vanity, arrogance, and invincibility, and you have proud man ready to tinker with God's complex economic plan. And that's what we're going to do in last seven lessons, is talk about how complex this is. And it isn't so simple as you go into some dark room somewhere and pull some levers and everything's going to come out all right. Remember earlier we said the curse is worse than God's curse? The cure is worse than God's curse? So, socialism in Russia, the red communism version. In our study we have the perfect storm. A Russia is ripe for major change in the economic realities. They're moving from serfdom, that is landed slavery, to new freedom. This upset worker produces unsettling times in Russia, in the workers who demand more of the Tsar. And remember, he was not able to deal with that, so he just killed a bunch of them. That didn't go well. We'll have less on this later. What happens to economies when technology displaces old jobs? A group of European ideologues have drunk the Kool-Aid of socialism brewed during the Enlightenment, when man began thinking for himself. And that was supposed to be a good thing. Everybody talks about how good the Enlightenment was. When man starts thinking for himself, it's not a good thing, because they gave up on God's revelation. Well, the idea promoted by Lenin is in exile in Switzerland, is looking for a revolution. You know, he comes from a dysfunctional family. I mean, they all were revolutionaries, even his sister. He's looking for a revolution. Anyone, anywhere. Just give me one, quick, like a fix. He knows that a political body in motion is steerable. So he needs something to get started. He can't start it from a dead stop. He can only hope for a revolution and then co-opt it. Now, remember, maybe you don't remember, but he had a world vision. He did not think that he would just have this socialism idea in Russia or in England, where he thought it would start, but he had a world scope vision. Remember that when you get to Nikita Khrushchev. When it occurs, he will take charge of it with the ideas of Marxism, even if it is against the people's will. You know, sometimes people just don't know what's good for them. So we have Russia's non-industrial revolt in 1906, 1905, 1917, that period, through the First World War, was against a weak czar. But it provided that very opportunity, March 15, 1917. By April, Lenin was in St. Petersburg to take charge. He came across Germany in wartime, and I showed you the engine last week that pulled him. It's in a museum somewhere. Now that's kind of interesting that he could make that trip in wartime over Germany into Russia. Well, apparently what the deal was, he was protected there by the Germans because they knew what Lenin wanted to do, and that was to get Russia out of the war. So they let him go. And that's exactly what he did. Of course, the Germans thought that after Russia would collapse, they would come overtake the land again. But, of course, that didn't work out either. Are any of you guys into Downton Abbey? Come on, admit it. All right, well, if you're not, you ought to get into it. It's quite interesting. It's set in the time period we're in. Socialism, only an idea. It has never been implemented successfully, even by the most meager standards of living. It must have an infusion of great wealth to sustain it. That alone defines it as a failure. So we have Downton Abbey's character, Tom Branson, is a socialist, and he mentions it quite regularly on his program or in his character. It's a BBC program. If you don't see it, it's on Sunday night. You might want to watch it in season 4 now, I think it is, so you can go back and get the old ones. Now you've got to be a little bit silly to want to watch that stuff, but it's really well done. Downton Abbey, Tom Branson claims to be a socialist, but he always talks about as an idea. And I'm thinking here, do you know, Tom, I'm playing his real role, do you know, Tom, what's going on in Russia when you're talking about this? You're killing people by the thousands. But he doesn't know it. So the setting is around 1922, 6 months in that period, season four, just at the end of Lenin's war communism, where all the killing went on, where all the starvation occurred because the farmers lost their fields and they didn't plant fields because they didn't have any and they took the grain. They had terrible, terrible time. The bad news of communism did not make it to England or to America, kinda. The news was so bad it was suppressed by Lenin. Socialists were not confronted with the failure. I'm going to stop here because I'll forget to say this. This period of time, you know that my background is Mennonite. It was at this time that those people that were stayed in Russia that did not come to the States or Canada or South America, wherever, that stayed there were in these conditions, and they wrote back and told us my ancestors, how things were in Russia. And it was at that time, some of you guys know this, the Mennonite Central Committee was formed. It still exists. I think it's got off track, as any social organization does. But it was originally set up to send relief to these people that were in this trouble. All right, so I want to just mention that, because at this time, in 1921, back to Lenin. But in 1921, at the end of Lenin's war communism, the new economic plan, which he had instituted because his war communism starved the people, provided some recovery using the principle of private property, an exclamation mark. How in the world can they do this in the face of socialism? Well, I guess capitalism is a bridge to socialism. So more free farmers began to privately produce food. They taxed them rather than took their food, to make up for the lost years when Lenin confiscated the farmland. Didn't give back the land, they just didn't make them give up all the grain. So far, socialism has only been an idea to be implemented. It must be talked about in the hypothetical, as I mentioned in the Downton Abbey series on BBC. When intellectuals talk about the value of socialism, it can only be discussed in the abstract. There has never been a successful socialistic culture. You're hearing an echo here? Even in the eternal kingdom, the economy will not be socialistic. Probably misunderstood by some Christians. Monarchical, perhaps, but no equality of anything. And the reward judgments preclude equality in the kingdom. As we've repeated here often, socialism is simply a feeble effort to explain how the dangerous world can be tamed, but with disastrous results. For example, 1998, now that's within the most of our lifetime, after the end of the Union of Socialist Republic, we couldn't come up with the name of those letters, USSR, the other day, so I looked it up, make sure I've had it right. It was demised in December 26, 1998. One, sometimes said 1992, because it's so close to the new year. 6 years after communism collapsed, in 1989, Russia received billions of dollars from the Western nations, the United States, largely from the International Monetary Fund, IMF, plus others. But it was not enough. Remember, this is 1998, not the wrong date. Not enough to save Russia's fledgling new economy after communism. The ruble collapsed in the world market, and the debts were unpayable. The medicine of socialism that killed plus 100 million people lost 74 years of national well-being. In the end, could not pay off all the debts of socialism, even with the influx of capitalist billions. And did the same for countless economies in the world. Wherever communism, it's always needed money. It always needs money. And in our last seven-week study, we're going to talk about international aid and how misguided some of this is. Because it always ends up in the pockets of somebody else. And is that a good idea anyway? So I have a little section on the Ukraine later, depending on my spirit later on in time. Russia. It is hard for Russia to maintain its population. This is now, after all of this. For every birth, there are two abortions. Women in poor health give birth to less than healthy babies. Infant mortality is low. Is the right way, is it high? Whichever it is. If you die, that means it's high, right? So it'd be high. Infant mortality is high at 23 per thousand. The United States is 6 per thousand, almost 7 per thousand. Drug use, 3 million habitual users, organized crime. I just didn't know how to say all this. Economic depression, alcohol poisoning. In 2000 a year, 35,000 died of alcohol poisoning compared to the United States, 300. The homeless, the school dropouts, the HIV infection, and all are largely due to socialism effect on standard living. I'm just mentioned now about this drinking. I remember in Ukraine, when we were there in 2004, the men were walking around drunk during the day, drove their cars into the back of trucks at night, and the women did all the work. They had nothing to do. That's the end of socialism. That was 10 years after USSR collapsed. We were there in 2004, so from 1992 to 2004 is 12 years. Written in 2002, I think, I couldn't get our date off this article. Nearly a decade after the end of communism, the essential task is still, still remains to be undertaken, building a free enterprise economy on the ashes of a centralized state-run system. Whereas in 1992, there was public support to see the job through, years of failed economic policy masquerading as reform, as crushing burdens of debt and discrediting of the United States in the eyes of the Russian people, have made the task for far more difficult than anyone could ever imagine. So they're kind of stuck. So I remember these guys up here. I guess this is a knockoff on the Beatles picture. Is that right? Somebody told me that. Again, socialism is only an idea. Even though it has never been done successfully yet, it continues to captivate intellectuals, believing it is to be the correct idea, only waiting for the right man to implement it. I looked up one of the articles I found was how many in the Harvard Law School, how many are communists? Socialists, whatever. Maybe you should use a socialist because communism as such doesn't exist. Socialists. And I think I was going to give it to you, but I'm going to go from memory. 80% are, and the other 20% are further to the left. And these are the places where our presidents are trained. How many of our presidents have come from Harvard? Don't name any. But, I mean, this is the place where they're getting their training. All would agree that Lenin and Stalin failed in an embarrassing outcome. It is failing in Cuba, Laos, Vietnam, North Korea, and China. But it's interesting, turn of events here, that China is lending us money. I don't know how much money they've got lent to us, but the United States now is $17 trillion. Did I say right? $1 trillion in debt. So I got to have this little comment in here. It's not meant to be political, but just think about it. The United States is attempting to live a socialist utopian dream. It has great reserves, but it cannot sustain what it offers the citizens. Someday, U.S. will run out of borrowing capacity, just like Russia did. Now, that's to scare anybody, but that's just got to be a matter of fact. And is it not this socialist utopian dream that's being presented to us? I don't care whose party you're, anybody. It's out there. We're supposed to make America better. Well, yes, but we do live in a dangerous world, and we can't make it a utopia. Some people will get hurt. Some will win. That's just the way it is with judgment. So all countries eventually work free of their economies begin to recover, if they're let alone. So we watch China's evolution. It's hard for these guys, once to get a little momentum going, to give up their power. That's sort of at the heart of all this anyway, is their power. But socialism must be forced on the people, and it is a bitter pill to swallow. Socialism in New Harmony was not forced because it was prepaid by Robert Owen. Thank you. When the money ran out, the project ended. Everybody goes home. You know, like going to somebody's party that they paid for all the food. When the food was gone, you went home. Socialism in Russia was forced on a weakened nation with a fledgling new government, upon a downtrodden people, disoriented, coming out of feudalism. Perhaps hope seemed to be in the revolution. It promised that the rich would give up their estates and wealth. That's a good idea. The Tsar did that. Well, that was about time he gave it up. So maybe it's our turn for the wealth. But the farmland was confiscated. Farmers quit farming. And with that came the famine, with a vengeance. Then the people had buyer's remorse. Too late. The European social architects believed that a revolution would spontaneously occur out of the Industrial Revolution. Advancing technology, science put tension between the old and the new ways of doing things. Hegel, Engels, Marx, all those guys said that. So they came up with this idea called dialectic materialism, the idea that class struggles, no one knows what a class is yet, by the way, but we have class struggles, they say, give way to new orders that are better than the old, even though it will cost something, and maybe a lot. It is inevitable because it's part of evolution. It is progress. Just as history is inevitable, not stoppable, changes bring a better tomorrow. Just look into the past, and is that not true? Doesn't that feel like Darwinism? Yes, it is. So the dialectic materialism, I try to find a pinball machine. I could have brought one up here for you and played it for you. I love pinball machines. I used to play them for a nickel, remember? And I always liked these ping balls. The balls would hit a little, you know, we call this post, and it would bounce somewhere. But all the pinballs I have always bounce to the gutter. But not so in the utopian ping ball machine. It always bounces upward. Higher and higher and higher and higher. So that's the dielectric materialism we're talking about. It bounces from one thing to the other, but it always gets higher and always gets better. The best always succeeds, and it always goes up. And we finally reach utopia. Okay? Now, you notice that not all those bounces always go straight up. Just some things bounce back a little bit, but the general correction is forward. So the path of inevitable progress is depended on by the socialists in their view of history. Now, remember, they don't have a God who has superintended history. Everything has been by accident. So here's a little lesson on this dialectic. Dialectic is a way of thinking. That's what it is. It's a way of thinking. As considering two opposing ideas, one will rise over the other, resolving the contradiction or opposition. This goes away and this stays. Then in time with new technology, another competition will rise. So we'll have competition. And this will give away, or the better one will give away, and it will rise. So we have this going on all the time. Remember about pinballs going up? We have this back and forth. Okay, and this is, they call it materialism because it is where you start the argument. We start with the idea that there is something. I'll read this to you. Materialism is where you start the argument. It is where you start the argument, but that's not how you start the argument. You got to decide which is it going to be first. Do you start the argument with a thought or an ideal, or do you start with a thing, a material? In other words, is it a thought that you start with? The first thing you're going to ever think about or ever do with your brain is you're going to think or you're going to feel. Well, you have materialism if you're going to feel. If you're going to think, you've got idealism. So Marx, those guys, they were materialists. You know, everything is connected to the material. There's nothing else but material. All connected to material. So materialism is where you start. That's where dialectic materialism comes from. You start with a thought. All right. If ideal, then you deny matter. Now, we have our friends down the road here, the Christian Science. They are the idealists. they drank the Kool-Aid from Hegel and others, but that's the idea, that there is no matter. It's all illusionary. There is no such thing as sin. Now, most people don't think that. In fact, I read, if you do a survey on this stuff, you find that most people think that ideals are, less people think that way. Most of them think in terms of material things, in terms of something you can touch and see. I'll give you an example. See what you are. A tree falls in the forest. Remember the old story? A tree falls in the forest. The idealist says there is no noise, since there is no ear that heard it. It is only noise if it is heard. A materialist says it makes noise whether anyone hears it or not. Noise is material and needs no ear to make it sound. So what are you? You're probably a materialist. All right, so now you have a little idea why Darwin was, or Marx was a materialist. He believed in, like we do, it doesn't matter whether you hear it or not, it's a material world. See, that's the difference where he's with Hegel. He was the idealist. Marx turned him on his head and made him a materialist. Same idea. You don't care about that. But back in the days, they argued this stuff. Now, the inevitable progress. But the inevitable needs help. That I'm still scratching my head about that. If something inevitable, how can you help it? Anyway, they think you got to help it. So in our summary, dialectic materialism is communism, it's the basis of communism, is a view of history that provides a theoretical mechanism, machinery, by which culture advances one over the other, and in that process makes progress. What do we hear today about the direction some of the country want to go? They want to go in the progressive direction. It's this idea, this progress. We're going up towards progress. They're not going to hell, all right, in their mind. They're going to heaven. Progress is always to heaven. Okay. Note, progress, a better tomorrow, is a matter of faith. How do we know what's going to bring? How do you know this dialectic is going to bring a better tomorrow? Has every war ever fought brought a better tomorrow? Or has every contest had the most moral win? Conclusion for them is, in the dialectic materialism, man is bettered to perfection, in fact, by the struggle. So this is a big thing. They understand man is not perfect yet, and he needs to go through the process to become perfect. Well, the question I have again, what determines that a change will bring a better world? Why cannot a dialectic produce a retrograde culture? What forces make it advance, as in progress? Now, materialism acknowledges no higher being that might, in providence, provide this guidance that doesn't exist in their thinking. It's all luck. Failing to acknowledge the God of history, they make the horrible mistake of assigning progress to a string of good luck. You can't have that much good luck. If you have that much good luck, you should make your ticket to get over to Las Vegas. So we have now the second law of thermodynamics denies this possibility. Things don't get better and better and more organized. Everything falls apart. And that is true in society too. So our second troubling assertion is that progress is inevitable. There is no personal responsibility, no room for volition or individual expression. All actions are compulsory because material in motion forces are determinative. By the way, this material is material in motion. It just doesn't stop. It's in motion in time. It is impossible to slow or hurry the sunrise, to borrow a wrong metaphor. Correspondingly, there is a wave of victory in the future as certain as the rising sun. This is how they see it. With the same certainty the ordained, and I always wonder, who ordains, shall conquer and rule the world? Well, there are no vestiges of doubt in the inevitable outcome, but the inevitable must be helped. Now, how sure are they in the outcome? I go back to my high school days. How sure is Nikita Khrushchev? As sure as Nikita Khrushchev was that communism will bury the United States, actually bury the West, but I'm sure he looked at the United States. At the final reception of Poland's visiting Gomulka, Stubby, Nikita Khrushchev, anybody remember him? Yeah. The old people? 1956? From 1953 on to 62. We're not going to do that tonight, Pete. Planted himself firmly with the Kremlin's whole hierarchy at his back, faced the diplomats of the West and the satellites with their intemperate speech that betrayed as much as it threatened. What did he say? "We are Bolsheviks," he declared pugnaciously. "We stick firmly to the Lenin precept. We don't be stubborn if you see you are wrong, and don't give in if you are right." What about the capitalist states? It doesn't depend on you whether or not we exist. If you don't like us, don't accept our invitations. If you don't invite us, don't come to see us. Whether you like it or not, history is on our side. We will bury you. He did accept an invitation to come to Iowa, 1959. I remember this very clearly, like as it was yesterday, because he came to Iowa. That's awful close to Nebraska. That was close to where I live. And here's Nikita Khrushchev, one state away. We were already married. Visiting the cornfields of the Garst Farm in Iowa, everyone thought that once old Nikita would see the glorious American accomplishment, he would go home, call off communism, and join the free market nations. Not so. Nikita had a different outlook. He was a communist. He saw the American achievement as far too small. Communism was to change the whole world, not just one country. Now, he said that after 30 years of ruthless socialism, which wasn't very well known. Well, the Star Wars Initiative 1983, launched by the United States, was a defensive system against the Soviets. It was beyond the reach of the Soviet economy. Couldn't pay for it. Gorbachev gave in and quit the fight, resigned in Christmas 1991. Is that a gift? It was kind of funny he did on Christmas Day. 1998, the Russian economy collapsed, having borrowed billions, I talked about that, from the IMF and whoever else. Talk about that later in the Ukraine pictures if I have time and am in the mood. $10 million loan, look at the date, 1996, 2 years before the collapse. The International Monetary Fund said today that it had approved $10 billion. Later on, the United States and Russia and other countries added $30 billion months before the collapse. Many of these last dollars paid off high-placed, well-connected Russians and foreign investors. There's your foreign dollars at work. Another more painful judgment than God's. No progress, no hope. This is recognized as a human need by the social engineers. If there is no progress in our present condition, we despair. And that will be true for us. Progress thus becomes the hope eternal springing forth in the chest. Their case is made this way. What brings progress? Well, science. You know, there's technology. And they say science all of a sudden becomes this infallible something. The inventors of the industrial age will displace workers who will organize and foment a revolution. This new age will be a better, stronger, and progress in a world marching on to perfection. See the dialectic going on? But has this been observed? Engels and Marx said, Then they quickly said, yes. And we ask, where did it happen? And they say, well, it happens right now in the struggle between slaves and owners, between the serfs and the feudal masters, the bourgeois, the capitalist and proletariat, the worker. That is, between the factory workers and the factory owners and the factory workers. Now, they saw a struggle. They totally misunderstood it. The dialectic conflict brings the unavoidable end. An international, worldwide workers' revolution transforming international society and future history. That was their hope. That's why Nikita Khrushchev wouldn't just sit down and say, I like to do what you guys do. No, our vision is much bigger than that. You guys are small-minded. You're just thinking about corn in Iowa. But It did not happen as predicted. Revolution did not come from the industrial West, but from Eastern Europe, where Russia was 100 years or more behind. If Lenin truly had an idea to be tested or discarded, a casual comparison of these two economies would have told him to rethink Marxism. But he did not. This gives substance to the idea that Lenin was not acting on altruistic impulses, if anybody thought he was, but was looking for a way to lead a revolution. Like I said, any kind, anywhere. Let me have it. He must have abandoned this idea of a worldwide revolution as a spontaneous event in England on the train ride from Switzerland to St. Petersburg. When he got to St. Petersburg, by the way, that was the name, and then I'm just using it because we know what where it is now. When he got to St. Petersburg in 6 months after he got there, he led the Red Army Revolution against the Provisional Kerensky government, the Provisional government after the Tsar. The Bolsheviks defeated it with violence, destroying the White Army. And there's a terrible, terrible scene in Dr. Zhivago. Dr. Zhivago is co-opted by the Red Army, and they're out. He's supposed to be, he's a medical doctor, so he's taking care of the wounded from the Red side. Of course, he's not sympathetic at all to the Reds. And the Reds are shooting indiscriminately into this field, and they see there's movement out there, look like soldiers in white uniforms, because they were the whites. So they mow them down with their Tommy guns and go look at what they shot. And they shot a school crowd of kids. Well, that's the way it goes. All right. Lenin was an enthusiastic advocate of violence. His revolution was on purpose, not a peaceful transition. By the way, Trotsky, remember him, is a gifted military strategist. The purpose of the revolution was not to seize control of the state, but destroy it. The state functions in many ways, executes the executive, the cabinet officers, legislative branches, the judicial, civil service, all are agencies of the government. The goal is not to secure these offices for Bolsheviks or communism, but to destroy them. They couldn't be salvaged. Wipe them out of existence and to build a totally new form of the state. So returning to the justification of violence. Objective, removing even the mild dissent, such as Burkham. Even though he was a brilliant communist intellectual, he represented a threat to Stalin. Just one example. Simply that Burkham question a premise of Marxism, which is that after the revolution, the state government, in other words, the Bolsheviks, would become smaller rather than larger. In fact, in Marx's idea that after socialism, there would be no government at all because man would be perfected. So when this government under Stalin, this is a few years later, now after 1928, gets bigger and bigger and bigger, this Burkham asks about that. Well, Uncle Joe, what do you think about our government getting bigger and bigger? Well, Stalin took that as insubordination. For him, it was a threat. He found a way to kill him as a traitor because he had not yet mastered dialectics. And thus, he was a clear and present liability. It was the intent of the revolution not to only eliminate all direct subversive resistance to communism, but also any who may in the future turn counter-revolutionary. This necessitates dragging a wider and wider net with a smaller and smaller, I call those holes in the net, spaces. And it was a task of thousands of three-member committees to sweep the land like an inquisition, looking for these would-be counter-revolutionaries. And they decided the fate of millions of the most productive human beings in Russia and in Ukraine. The most productive, the most intelligent, the most innovative people were the greatest threat to the government. So what do you get, what you have left? If they thought someone might pose a threat later, infected by the old ideas, they might get discouraged or whatever, they were either killed or sent to Siberia to work in the labor camps. Now, we're near Ukraine. This is at a town I can never say. It's Dnipropetrovsk. I see it. I can probably get it out. It's a city on the Dnieper River named after Peter in Russian. Now, if you look carefully, what do you see? Faces. Faces of people that were killed because they were industrialists or threats to the Russian communism. Now, again, I've got to resort to my Mennonite background. The Mennonites were very industrious people. They were German people. And they were innovators. They were building combines and threshers and binders, discs, things that you would use for farming. And they were very successful. And they was being used greatly in Russia. In fact, I think they said 1/6 of the farm implements came from the Ukraine at one time. Who'd they kill? These guys. The guys that invented the stuff had to know how to build it because they were a threat. So this is a memorial to these people. In fact, when we were there, they said, told us, we were about 200 people. It says, if you know people in your family, in your history, that were killed, we want to know about them. We want to put them in more, memorialize them. Is that the right word? Put a memorial up for them. So now this is in the Ukraine. And do you notice the news today? Yep. This is in the Ukraine. Interesting. Well, Christian ideals are absent in socialism. Christianity is an enormous threat to the godless. They prefer the destructive elements of socialism rather than enjoy the benefits of God's providential care in the gift of biblical economics. So I give this to you before how they see it goes up. They go up towards utopia. Won't go through that again. But it is so sad. It is so sad. It does not need to be that way. You know, we live under judgment the way it is. Why does mankind have to put on yet another layer of judgment? I told you about the Mennonite Central Committee formed in 1920. That's 1921. I missed it a year. Okay. I have 5 minutes. I got some pictures from the Ukraine that we took when we were there in 2004. 2004, it's never going to, 19 will never get out of my head. You know, life really began in 1937, so don't get that out of here. I didn't think I'd live to see 2000, I guess that's why I never really planned on being able to use it. Anyway, here we are, 2014, and we're at the end of February almost already. All right, so I'll give you some pictures here. I might go a little over if you got to go, that's fine. This is, so if I refer to myself, my heritage, I'm just apologize for that. But this is the area we came from. This is the Crimea. I was going to show you the bigger map. Off to your right, down here on this map, down to the right over here, is where the Olympics were. You could have driven there by car in just a few hours. So that's the area of the world we were. And the Ukraine is considered by Putin, and that's what we have now, is the most desirable of the Baltic, if that's a Baltic state, of the states around Russia. It used to be part of the USSR. I have heard some high percentage of the black dirt on the earth is in Ukraine. I mean, it's huge, like 25%, something really astronomical figure like that. So it is the breadbasket of Europe. It could be. But it takes very, very good farming skills to make it produce because it's dry. But it can be done. The Mennonites did it. So what I see here is just the colony that where the Mennonites lived. And I would like to know. My parents came from in this. Can you see my arrow? My dad came from one of these in here, and my grandpa came from in here. And Wanda's parents came from down here. So when you talk about the Ukraine, I get really interested in it. So here we have their latest up-to-date farming machinery. This is not a hobby, folks. This is actual work. This is a horse that pulled a wagon. What year was that abandoned in the United States? Probably in the 40s, maybe 30s in some places. My dad didn't want horses because they quit working at 6. So on our farm, we never did have a horse to farm with, never had a horse to ride. Okay, this is the farming procedures, how you harvest grain. This is corn. We never shock corn. We shock wheat, but never corn. You do this to dry it out. Now, you see the landscape is quite nice. You see how black the dirt is? And how rolling it is. You don't see stones and rocks and outcrops. It's black dirt. Good stuff for farming. Now, these are the tractors. These are collective farming tractors. This is after socialism collapsed. This is now Ukraine's an independent country. But they gave the land back to the people. Everybody got, we don't know how many acres, you said 35. It was something small amount of acres. Each person got 35 acres, but each farmer, each person got 35 acres, but you didn't know where it was. So what they do for you? Well, I said, if you have 35 acres, we'll lease it from you for $5. You know, some low, stupid figure like that. Well, what else can I do? I'll take my $5. So the collectives gather all this land together, and then they farm it. But it's not very productive, as you can see. These are old tractors. You got a blue one, there's a little more modern, but these other ones are really quite old. They've got to be out of the 20s and 30s. Now, there's a pretty new tractor, four-wheel drive yet. But that was the newest thing we saw. Again, we have almost, these are called the steppes of the Ukraine. They're just flat plains, and you see there's grass. They could be growing something on it. And you'd have some wheat. We were there in September, October, so wheat was planted. But you see a lot of the fields are not planted with wheat. Looks like normal farms, farmland. Now, the Mennonites generally left there by 1920. Some were stayed through 1920 through Stalin's purges, and a lot of them died during Stalin's purges. And they were there again when Germany attacked Russia. They were German-speaking people, so they were persona non grata in Russia because they looked like they were not loyalists because of their language. So when the Russians were done with them, the Germans took care of them. So they had this back and forth. And then they had that, beside that, the Tartars, the Muslims, would raid their farms and steal and kill and pilter and rape. So this is how the people lived. But in spite of that, they built pretty nice houses. And they always have this kind of a look about them that you always identify a Mennonite house. This is an especially interesting house. This is a personal story. One of my favorite people when I was growing up was a guy named John B. Taves, T-O-E-W-S. And he had a brother named Jake. They were outstanding Bible teachers. They were Canadian. They talked with that kind of a Canadian-German accent. Anyway, this is where he lived. This was his birthplace. And this guy, you see, my wife's there right in front of him. It's his son was on this trip with us. So he told me about that. And he said, this is where Dad preached first. And I want to say he was an outstanding Bible preacher. He really was. In fact, I was down in Beatrice one time at the Mennonite church when Jacob was preaching and enjoyed him very much. That's the first time I ever heard a preacher talk about a pregnant idea. And I've never forgot that. It's a pregnant idea. Okay, I got the idea. Didn't talk like that, you know. All right, that's the church. These farmers lived in, some of them lived in great luxury. This was a house. I guess I have a picture. Behind it is a mill, huge mill, still being used today. They had windmills they brought with them from Poland, in Holland, because they pump water to drain the ocean out of their land. This is in Holland. They also did that in the Vista Delta for the Poles, which we find out they're not Poles at all. They're Prussians. Remember we talked about that? This is the last of the windmills that stand there. And then I just love kids. Just love the kids. And I think, you know, 10 years later, since we were there, those kids are now teenagers, and they're living in what's going on in Ukraine. There's normal kids. This is the area where my grandpa came from. Now, all of these are Ukrainian people. None of the Mennonites are left. They're all gone. We saw two ladies there. They were in their 80s that married Ukrainians, and that's why they stayed. The Ukrainians are a little kind of identified by the eyes are close set, dark-haired, pleasant people. And I always liked girls anyway. Had so many in my house. So see girls again. You don't want a picture of boys like that, would you? Oh, it wouldn't do any good. This is any school. Now, this is what the girls looked like when they grew up, and they're called, what are they called? Huh? Bushkas, yeah. Is it Bushka or Babushkas? Babushkas, yeah. And you can tell their living wasn't necessarily easy. And this is their grocery store. Or their place. This is the 710 or 711. They call it 711. And if you go shopping, you buy your clothes off the back of a wagon or car. You see the back? I can't point here very well. Right here. This is a car. It drives in there. It comes every week or so, and they sell clothes. You don't go to a store to buy stores, to buy clothes. There are no stores. And there is some in Zaporozhye, but that'd be way, way too far for these poor people to ever go. So they bring the merchandise to them. And the kids we saw, they're not that poorly dressed. They're making go. And this one and this one are just two pictures of the same place. One of those kind of tearjerker stories, because people that got on the train that went away from us ended up in Siberia. People that got on the train and went towards my back went to freedom. And it depended on which way you got on. It's something you didn't know where it was going. That's how it worked out. In Zaporozhye, where there are a compilation of people, we see a building being erected. It's been that way for years. It ran out of money. Wanda's niece was there for 10 years. She says, everybody wants to get out of the Ukraine. No one wants to stay. All the young people went out. If they could just get out, if they had some place to go, if somebody would just take them, they'd be gone. But you can't build a country with that kind of attitude. And why should they stay? It's so depressed, so discouraged. Remember in 2004, we saw these demonstrations. Well, these were not demonstrations. These were political campaigns. And the issue that they're facing in the Ukraine now was the issue here already. You had a pro-Western president running against a pro-Russian president. And at that time, the pro-Russian president won. I think they've been in power. And that's the issue right now, because the western part of the Ukraine wants to be part of the West. The east part of the Ukraine wants to be part of Russia. Putin wants Ukraine like you can taste it, because it's his prize catch. It's the best piece of land there is available outside of Russia. So that's why the battle is going on. And the Kiev, by the way, is in the territory, what would be called Eastern Ukraine. So they have a battle. If you read anything about the history of World War II, you find that the Jews, Kiev was a huge place for, great place for Jews to live. This is Barbie. Can't say it. Two names. It was the name of the lady who owned the land. And this is where the Jews were lined up and buried. And you see still the trenches that are visible. And on the right, you see the edges of the trench. And this is underneath this ground. There are thousands of Jews that were buried in Kiev, because there were a lot of Jews in Kiev. We'll take you up to Russia. You know, it's one of those kind of things. You walk through the Kremlin. We walked through the museums, we walked through the churches, we walked into St. Basil, the pretty one. We walked by Lenin's, not tomb, but his mausoleum where he lays in state. And it's 2004, only 10, 12 years after Russia collapsed. It's just almost like, are we doing this? Are we doing what we're doing? You know, what you saw there is where the May Day parade always occurred. All the military was paraded by it. That's called the GUM, the white building called the GUM. Was paraded by there with all the military and they're strutting their goose steps. That's where they walk by for the Russian dignitaries to watch their power on display. Another place we visited would be St. Petersburg. This is the Summer Palace. This is where St. Catherine the Great, remember, she was the one that collected all the art. Now, this is the Tsar, so she would have died in 1796. And her son Paul, do we have Alexandria, Nicholas, two Alexanders, and Nicholas again. Then we get to our Nicholas. Anyway, this is the place where she lived. This is the place where the Tsar that was executed lived, Tsarina. Beautiful, beautiful place. Ever heard of the Amber Room? It's in this palace. I didn't bring you a picture of that. But I did bring you a picture of the Tsar. They've sort of rehabilitated them and his wife and put them up in this, what they call the Summer Palace. The Winter Palace was downtown St. Petersburg. And this hurt my heart, crushed me terrible. This is back in the area where the Mennonites came from. We have the bust of Karl Marx and of Lenin. Why do they have those guys up as a memorial, considering what they did to their land, it's incredible. All right, I didn't give you a thus far, but that is the thus far.